Is your costume ready? Is your pumpkin carved? Halloween is that special day of the year where it's totally normal to see ghouls, princesses, and superheroes roaming the streets in search of treats. And the big day is almost here. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about the history of Halloween and what it takes to decorate a truly spooky house or assemble a memorable costume are Cappell's Inc. owner, Ray Cappell, Northside resident, Renee Micheo, and New York Times reporter, Amy Ortiz. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us over.
Thank you.
Amy, Halloween wasn't always the massive holiday it is now. Tell us a little bit about the history of Halloween in the United States.
Halloween, you know, actually came over from, you know, Ireland and Scotland with immigrants. And it really wasn't a giant holiday for a very long time. So much so that in 1876, the New York Times even said that the holiday was departed. You know, it was, nobody was going to be celebrating this in the future, and that we would look back on it as a sort of quaint tradition, like how funny it was that people used to do this. And of course, that is obviously no longer the case. It is, according to the National Retail Federation, spending is supposed to reach $13 billion this year. And it's been something of a long road from quaint tradition to $13 billion. Really, the big boom happened once, you know, you sort of reach the 1900s and trick-or-treating comes about as a way to sort of buy off these children who were just sort of playing the most awful, like, pranks that could happen for that time. For example, disassembling and then reassembling a farmer's buggy on, like, a barn roof, which... like just these feral children running around. And so they needed a way to keep these kids busy. And so they started trick-or-treating. Also, they would set up these things called trails of terror in their basements or in the local parks. And that is, you know, sort of the origin of the haunted houses and sort of trails of terror that we see now.
You've done a great job laying out that history for us, Ray. How long has Halloween been an important part of your business at Cappell's, and how important is the holiday for your stores?
It became a very major part of our business back in probably the 70s, maybe the mid-70s. We were in the Christmas and holiday business, basically. And so we had Halloween as a side business, you know, earlier, but we didn't really understand the business. And the business is, for us, a very last-minute business. A very quick story. The first year we carried this, we carried like maybe, oh, a dozen styles of the latex mask that are out there. And we put them on styrofoam heads. And this guy from New York who we bought them from said, you know, you're going to do really well with these. Well, we put them out, and it was like 2 weeks before Halloween. And I'm looking at them, I'm saying, gosh, we have the same amount of these as we had when we started, you know? And it got to be all the way down to probably 2 or 3 days before Halloween, and poof, they were all gone. And we weren't used to that because Christmas and holidays were business that people prepared for, you know, for a long time going into the holiday. Halloween was very last minute. So we started to recognize that this is going to be a part of our business because we're in the party business, and Halloween obviously is an offshoot of that, and it became more and more of a main thing. There was a same gentleman who I'm referring to out of New York said to me something that I didn't believe at the time. He made a quote to me. He said, you're going to find at some point in the future that Halloween is going to be your biggest time of year. And of course, I was thinking to myself, no, there's no way that's going to probably happen. But I'll listen to what you have to say. So it started then going into the 80s and the 90s. It started to become more and more and more part of our business. And we also noticed that it just wasn't children anymore, okay? It was adults that were looking to cut loose on weekend parties. And it is such an important part of our business today that if we weren't in the Halloween business and if we weren't in the costuming business year-round, we probably wouldn't be around because we had to adapt in our business to say, what's going on here? Where are things taking us? And so the importance of Halloween to us is paramount right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Renee, Ray just said there in the party business, you live in Northside, which is a neighborhood that loves to party. I think all of us know that around here. It's so big on Halloween. You all tend to do it in a big way. Tell us about Northside's brand of Halloween.
I tell you, when I joined the neighborhood in Northside, I started meeting people that were a little odd. And I was like, I like it here. A lot of artists and a lot of, you know, neighborhood care into what we present. And there was my neighbor, Tina Gutierrez, and she covered her house on a cobweb, two-floor house. And I was like, I can't compare. Well, I just went out and got some stage lights and big monstrophic things that they were not, you know, terrifying. They were just like visually pleasant and attractive on the style of Halloween. And by the way, since I joined, since Night Ballet, I used to drop by to your store and get us the stage makeups.
Oh, yeah.
It started growing, and I saw the trend that if we had a big movie out on the cinemas, and the theme was for, you know how many Elsas I had? So my DJ box, it was I Saw an Elsa and Poe. That was the track for them. And you can see them just light up because it was their turn. It was really, really nice.
Oh. What are you planning this year? Can you give it away? What your house is going to look like this year?
I'm thinking of Elton John.
Oh.
And it's a whole party outside, a lot of lights, disco balls, and huge costumes, everybody with glasses at my house, and just a lot of noise. It's the scary part comes to play into how big a house is looking like and attractive. And I do have a few chainsaws hidden. It's just one of those propellers that cuts the grass.
Oh, like a weed eater kind
of
thing.
Yes, a weed eater. And I just have a remote, so unexpected sounds.
Are you going to dress as Elton John? Is that your costume?
Yes.
One of the Elton Johns. You could be almost anything and dress
anything,
like Elton John.
As long as it's huge and, you know, a lot of sparkle.
Yeah.
I also set up a kind of like a, not a booth, but one of those pop-up tents. And it has a screen, it's a backdrop, it's green. And people come through the candy and go through the booth. And I take their photographs. I have a photography studio, so it's easy for me just to pop something up and a light. Some of the families that have come through, it says, you know, we never had our family portraits taken.
And,
and that right there is just like, okay, I'm doing this.
Yeah. So you're giving more than candy. You're giving portraiture.
And at night, you know, I go back and design a backdrop with the Northside and the year scary theme. And then I just put it on Facebook Northside. And you see everybody really, really likes that.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, Amy, you mentioned $13 billion. That's what people are in the U.S. are expected to spend on Halloween this year. Where are we spending that? I mean, is that candy? Is that costumes, decorations? I mean, where's all that money going?
I mean, it's everything. When I wrote the story on sort of the evolution of Halloween retail last year, one of the things that one of my sources said was, you know, Halloween is a marketer's dream because it's largely consumable. You know, kids don't want to wear the same costume the next year, so you're going to need to get a new one. You know, candy gets eaten up. You might want to change the theme of your house. Maybe this year you're doing, I guess, a haunted Elton John, which sounds amazing. Like, I want to go check that out. Maybe you want to do next year a different, you know, like witch's lair or something like that. So it's spent on everything. And as was mentioned, you know, it's not just kids anymore. Adults have really, really, you know, honed in on Halloween, millennials in particular. And so it's adult costumes, it's children's costumes, it's candy, it's decorations, it's absolutely everything that you could think of.
We'll continue our conversation after a short break. And later in the program, we hear some spooky stories from a local storyteller. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our recorded conversation about Halloween, what it takes to decorate a truly spooky house, and the secret to a memorable costume. My guests are Kappel's Inc. owner, Ray Kappel, Northside resident, Renee Macheo, and New York Times reporter, Amy Ortiz. Ray, what trends are you seeing with costumes this year, and how tricky is it to kind of predict what people are going to want when you're stocking your shelves?
Wow. Very tricky, okay? People will call us looking for video player-type costumes or video game costumes, and it can change weekly as to what they're looking for. But the good thing about it is that we stock and we pride ourselves in stocking a lot of hard-to-find items. When you come into our stores, you'll find not just a half a dozen wigs, you'll find hundreds of wigs. You'll find hundreds of hats. You'll find just literally such wide selections of things. So when people call us for what's popular, we may say we don't have something licensed from that, but we have so many accessories that you could probably put it together. Plus, our importers can't react quick enough to a lot of the things that become popular. You know, probably one of the driving forces this year, if there's anything we're hearing of, are K-pop characters.
Oh, yeah, K-pop demon hunters, right?
You got it. You got it. And so we did put in that line of wigs for both children and adult, and we also are carrying the K-pop jackets for children and adults as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We are talking in this recorded interview about people who go all out for Halloween. And Renee, that brings me to you. What are some of the big themes of the past, like the COVID years, some recent years, big themes for your house or the neighborhood that you can remember?
What it really was a hit was when I had the rotten sugar plum. My porch became a stage with lights and mirrors. And I had a witch. It was Elaine Deal's daughter.
Oh, our colleague yes, Elaine Deal from WGUC, her talented daughter, huh?
Yes. She was the witch, and she was the modern dancer, while the sugar plum was on point with a tutu and a messed up makeup, of course. And I was the superhero. So I was trying to save each other from each other. And that was like a two-hour dance. You know, we actually did part of the Nutcracker on the stage, and my husband, Daryl Pajosa, that is the director of the SCPA, he was passing the flyers for the Nutcracker. So it's like, come and see the show.
Very clever. Yeah.
So the pathways, you know, my front street, it was covered with people. And the parents are like, let's go. We have more houses to hit. It became like an actual show. It was really, really a nice run.
That sounds spectacular. And for the kids and I guess the families who stop by your house, Renee, is it about the candy or is it about the experience? It sounds like it's a whole experience at your house.
Yes. Candy. What's on your bowl? But, you know, as soon as they have the candy in their bag, they're like, okay, so what is going on here?
Candy first, experience second.
At this point, we are in around $350 in candy. We get like 500 kids.
Oh, my.
It is massive. Yeah. The whole Haight Street on Northside really puts it together. And we see minivans at the end of the street dropping kids from another neighborhood.
Wow. 500 kids. I don't know if this is a tangent, but what's trick-or-treating like in New York City? I mean, does it just get wild trick-or-treating there?
I grew up in the area, so I will tell you from experience, it's kind of the most wonderful madness. Either you live in a building where it's very, you know, everybody sort of knows each other and you can kind of go door to door in your own building, or you can go outside and you go this is what my family would do. We would go down sort of the street and go to like the shops, and it's madness. It's every single child like out at the same time, you know, especially if it's during the week after school, going shop to shop to shop, trying to get candy. One of the things that sticks out in my brain a lot is seeing shopkeepers put up signs like "No more candy," because you got there too late in the day, and I'm just like, "Oh my gosh!"
Are the costumes just spectacular in New York? I have visions of just spectacularly dressed kids roaming the streets.
Oh yeah, but I would also say the costumes are also spectacular on adults. You know, like this isn't like people are going all out, the parents as much as the children. You know, and so you would see sort of, you know, if it's a small child is like Robin Hood, you see Robin Hood's gang with him. You know what I mean? It's absolutely magnificent. And if you ever have the wonderful privilege of spending Halloween in New York, you also get the beautiful experience of seeing all of these people in these elaborate costumes try to figure out how to take the train. And that's also just one of the best things to like happen on this planet once a year.
That sounds super fun.
Yeah, you know, you haven't lived until you've seen a giant chicken try to figure out how it's going to, you know,
get on the subway.
get on the subway, you know, and they're just standing there like, well, I don't fit through the, you know, turnstile.
Chickens can't fly. We all know that.
Yeah. And they can't fly.
Yeah. Ray, you mentioned that, you know, Halloween's not just for kids anymore. You get lots of adults coming to the shop looking for costumes. What about family costumes? Like, you know, what Amy just described, do you have people coming in saying, we need a theme, we are all going to dress as something together?
Oh, yeah, we do. And I would say we get it from families who are, they want to go out trick-or-treating, and they all want to be a group. There's various things that they can, you know, take and do to do that. Also, we'll get people come in that just want to go out and party for that night or for the weekend. They want to be like a group of bananas, let's say, okay? Or there's all kind of fun things that we have that they can do as groups. And also couple costumes are still a pretty big deal too. So the gangster and flappers, and there's a lot of traditional ones, but a lot of people want to be really creative. And I think the greatest way that they can be creative is that how they accessorize their costume, you know, what that hat looks like, what that those eyeglasses, what the weapon or whatever it is they're going to be carrying with their costume. That's what sets them apart at the parties. And I think that when they come in to see us, it's sort of like they don't want to go to that party and look the same as someone else. They want to be sure they have that accessory that makes them different, or that makeup on that makes them different. I think that's what it's all about, what we see these days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's important for kids too. I can remember my dad made me a Cleopatra costume, and one of the highlights was a gold like snake thing that went around my
armband
he got at Kapples.
There you go. Well, great.
Yeah. Well, Renee, what about the Skeleton House? I understand that's a place in Northside where you've got a bunch of people dressed in the same kind of costume. Can you tell us about that?
And that will be my neighbor.
Oh, this neighbor you're competing with.
it's not quite a competition. Like, we are like a different pattern.
You know? Yeah.
She does have a very loud speaker and a lot of smoke, and they are always these dancing skeletons. Tina Gutierrez. There you go, Tina.
That's right.
One of my favorite groups, that it was a current situation. I don't know if you recall all those miners that got buried, and mm-hmm. then we all are getting the updates of where they were. Well, I had all the miners show up that Halloween.
Oh, my gosh.
And they had gotten some items from Kapples. The very nice part that I enjoy from the North Side is that the politics don't play a role on the costumes. Everybody keeps Halloween for what it is. Mm. You know, even whatever we're going through, no, nothing shows up. It's very nice. It's very kid-friendly.
Oh, that's great. Amy, you mentioned at the top of our conversation that the New York Times predicted the end of Halloween many years ago. Obviously, we're not there yet. Do you think the end is anywhere in sight?
No. I think Halloween captures part of the imagination that no other really holiday really does. You know, you get to sort of interact with your fears in a very, very safe way. And I think that that's something that will always call to people. I think it's also one of the few holidays that's not about kind of like other people. It's sort of just like a party for a party's sake almost. And I think that that really speaks to people. So I don't see this going away. I see, you know, maybe there'll be a turn at some point to more like homemade costumes again or something along those lines, sort of depending on, you know, what the economy looks like and things of that nature. But I think Halloween has captured something that it just, there's nothing like it. And it continues to grow, not just in the United States, but globally. You know, there are countries where Halloween was not a thing. It does not have the history that it has here in the United States, where it is now a very, very popular holiday as well. And with that growth, that just means more people. And so I think Halloween's around for forever.
Yeah. Renee and Ray, what do you think? Are you into Halloween for the long haul? How long do you think you'll be dressing up and decorating your house, Renee?
Let me check how old am I. I am in to stay. Is it true? I did read, or it was just a rumor, that the treats themselves started when people were giving some sort of pastries with raisins to other people to go pray for the lost souls or something to that effect. And I heard that they were terrible, burning houses and doing all these horrifying things when somebody said, hey, let's make a party and let's give candies, maybe bring them in. And so that kind of changed the path of Halloween, I guess. I don't know, that might be just another Halloween tale. But.
Yeah, I think Amy talked about that the treats were like bribes to keep the hooligans from wreaking havoc. Ray, what about you? Are you in for Halloween for the long haul? I mean, it seems like it's become a really important part of your business at this point.
It has been. I mean, Capples is 80 years old this year, and it's pretty phenomenal when I think back of all the people I've seen that have come and gone, you know. And I still get up every day. I'm still very positive. I enjoy Halloween. I enjoy the costuming business that we do year round. I'm in it for the long haul, as long as my health holds up.
There you go.
Yeah.
Hey, maybe you can come back as a ghost.
I'll be on your porch.
Don't tap me on the shoulder. Okay.
Well, I've been talking with Capples Inc. owner Ray Capple, Northside resident Renee Macheo, and New York Times reporter Amy Ortiz. Thank you all so much for your time today. It's been so much fun.
Same here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, tall tales and spooky stories. This is Cincinnati Edition. This Halloween, will you curl up with a dog-eared copy of H.P. Lovecraft or gather round with friends for a campfire tale of terror? So many of us delight in the horrifying and long to escape into a good story. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to share tall and terrifying tales before they appear at the Cincinnati Storytelling Festival are storyteller, author, and recording artist Bill Lepp. Thanks for being here, Bill.
Glad to do it.
And storyteller, theater artist, and Cincinnati Storytelling Festival artistic director, Paul Strickland. Welcome back, Paul.
Thanks, Lucy. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Storyteller or liar, that's the question. Bill, I understand you are an award-winning liar. So is there really any difference between a liar and a storyteller?
I don't think so, not when you're doing it. If you're lying to deliberately trick people, obviously that's bad. If you're doing what I'm doing on stage, no, it's wonderful.
Fair enough. So what does a good tall tale need to keep your audience enthralled, Bill?
It has to be something that they can connect with. You have to find some sort of commonality with the audience. And then, in my opinion, once you've established that you have something in common, then the storyteller slowly departs into the impossible. And before people realize that you've left the realm of possibility, you're engaging in some wonderful exaggeration.
Okay, Bill, well, let's hear one of your whoppers.
Well, I was a minister for about 4 years, and I was in a little tiny town in Fayette County, West Virginia, and the local religious leaders decided that all the pastors ought to come to Beckley for a meeting. I volunteered to drive. I was driving home, and I had the Catholic priest and the Baptist minister in the back seat of my car, and I had won, as a door prize, an offering plate about as big around as a trash can lid. It was lined with plush velvet, and etched around the side of it was 401k. And my dog, Buck Dog, he's my super dog. His mother was a German Shepherd. His father was a Basset Hound. He looks like a German Shepherd that swallowed a kayak. He had curled up in the offering plate and gone to sleep. And naturally, being three pastors, we'd stopped on the way home and bought a bucket of fried chicken. Well, we were going down Sandstone Mountain. A blizzard hit. I was forced to pull over to the side of the road. We weren't sure what to do. I looked in the rearview mirror, and I saw an 18-wheeler coming down the mountain, totally out of control. And just before it hit, it was headed straight for the car. Just before it hit, Buck Dog sensed the tension, woke up, looked out the back window, saw what was about to happen, grabbed that bucket of fried chicken, and pulled it in the offering plate with him. So when the truck hit, it shot Buck Dog out the windshield in that offering plate with the fried chicken flying through the sky. And then me and the Catholic priest and the Baptist minister, we went out the window next. So there we were, a priest, a Baptist minister, a Methodist pastor flying through the sky. Not a punchline in sight. And then the truck split in half. It was carrying tennis shoes, and about 50,000 pair of shoes flew out of the truck. Well, Buck Dog flew all the way down the mountain to the New River, which was frozen over, and he bounced so hard in that offering plate that it knocked his hind end out of the offering plate. But the chicken was still in the offering plate, so Buck was holding on as tight as he could with his front end. And he slid across the ice, and then me and the priest and the minister slid across after him in a somewhat tangled ecumenical movement as those 50,000 pair of shoes fell in the woods. And I said to those two guys with me, I said, I sure hope nobody's watching us, because here we are, three preachers living up to all the stereotypes people have about clergy. What with us out on the thin ice, chasing half a buck in the offering plate and a bowl full of fried chicken while 100,000 souls are lost in the wilderness behind us.
Bravo, Bill. That's spectacular.
Thank you.
Well, I know we can hear more tales like that at the upcoming Cincinnati Storytelling Festival. Paul, I know you are also a liar, although I understand you prefer the term fictionalist. So I will, you
nothing
know, honor
so pretentious
that.
As that. Right. Yeah, sure, sure, yeah.
I understand you have a story about the boatman and a tunnel.
Yeah, so I just thought this story is so perfect for talking about like what Bill and I do a little bit differently. My friend told me this story about why storytelling is important. Specifically fictional stories, these old stories. Her dad was a boatman in Europe, and he had this tiny boat, like a two-seater, that he would stand in the front of, and then he would take tourists up the canals and the tunnels, right? Take them through the tunnels. And one day, he was on his third trip, and he had this couple in the boat that seemed a little reticent, you know? And he took this right turn into this long, long, long tunnel, and you could see the dime-sized exit at the end where there was light pouring in. It's beautiful. You know, he never took it for granted. And he was just admiring this beautiful thing, this dime-sized exit of light pouring in, when the couple behind him start freaking out. I mean, they start panicking. They're like, stop the boat. Stop the boat. They're in Italy. Stop the boat. And he turns around and he says, what is wrong with you? And they're saying, this boat is too big to fit through that hole. And he looks at them and they said, I can see with my own two eyes, this boat is too large to go through the exit. And he said, no, it's okay. He did this important thing. He didn't jump to judge. he jumped to help. He said, "It's okay. I have a friend at the end of the tunnel who I pay to turn a crank, and it opens up the exit as we get closer." And the couple calmed, and they sat down, and they enjoyed the ride that was going to happen, whether they panicked or not. Because these fictional stories, these old stories, are sometimes what I need to see that I can get through. They're what I need to see that I can make it through to the other side. On the other side, the boatman got out. He helped the tourists out like he always did. And they tipped him handsomely. But as they were walking away, the boatman looked up and said, "Excuse me, could you also spare a tip for my friend who turns the tunnel crank?"
That's just good business, right?
Just
there.
Good business. That's right.
So, Bill, do people ever try to get the two of you to admit how much of your story is true and what you made up?
Yes. And my general response to that is, while my stories aren't always true, they're always honest. Because even though I'm talking about some pretty wild things that happen, the emotions and the responses that people have to the stories, I want them to walk away believing in the things that they felt. And so if I say, "Oh, no, that's not true," then that kind of diminishes the feelings that I've created for them to walk away with feeling better. And so I tell them, it might not have happened exactly that way, but everything in it is honest.
The thing I say that's very much similar to Bill's, most of my stories are in fact not factual, but they are true. And so what I hope is that when people hear the lack of factualness and have fun with that, what they end up doing is walking away with something that is true for them.
I tell a story where I get stuck on the back of a coal train and I have to build a hot air balloon out of litter and my own clothes to escape the balloon. And while I'm waiting for something, I say I read a little Aristotle while I was waiting. So it's a 7-minute, nonsense. And this woman, normal looking woman, came up to me afterwards and said, "Did all of that happen just like that?" And I couldn't tell if she was joking. And so I said to her, "No, ma'am, I've never read any Aristotle." And she said, "I thought so," and walked away. So,
boy, I bet you still didn't know she was yanking your chain by the end of that conversation.
To this day, if you're out there, ma'am, let us know.
Yeah. Well, we are hearing tall tales and spooky stories in this recorded interview. And Bill, I want you to lay another one on us, another one of your tall tales.
Well, my friend Ferndale, her parents were Izzy and Whimsy, and before I was born, they owned a store in town called Whimsy and Izzy's Used Boots and Coffins, and sometimes coffee. And believe it or not, that went out of business. And so they took all of the coffins and they took them up to their farm. And if you went to Ferndale's farm, you would think that her parents farmed coffins because there were just coffins laying everywhere. It turns out, though, that they weren't farming coffins, and what they were farming is legal now in several states. But Miss Whimsy was our Cub Scout den master, and she had integrated boys and girls into the Cub Scouts long before that was legal. And when it came time to build our Pinewood Derbies, the Cub Scouts get a 5-ounce block of pine with 4 little plastic wheels. You're supposed to carve that into an F1 race car. She said, "That's silly. You guys are big kids. You don't need a car you can push down a track. You need cars you can ride in." And so we went up to Ferndale's farm, and Mr. Izzy helped us each pick out our coffin. Most people, if they're lucky, get to pick out their coffin once. When you grew up with Ferndale, you got to pick out a coffin on multiple occasions because they were just everywhere. They used them as coolers and above ground planters. Mr. Izzy had turned one into a still. When we played hide and seek or had sleepovers, we slept in the coffins. And so we each picked out our own coffin, and Mr. Izzy helped us put wheels and a steering wheel on it so that we had they looked like a soapbox derby car, but we called them a ghost box derby car. And then they had beautiful names like my buddy Skeeter and his girlfriend Charlay. They had a tandem. It was called His and Hers. And there was one called Carcophagus. And Toad Gilkey, his was a wicker casket. He called it To Hell in a Handbasket. And my favorite name, of course, was my coffin, and it was To Go Box. And we took them up to the top of Pity Me Mountain so that we could race them down. And then the other adults found out that we were going to race our Ghost Box Derby cars down Pity Me Mountain, and they wouldn't let us. So we ended up racing them in the school. And this story doesn't really have an end. I mean, it does, but I don't have time to tell it here. But that's the world that I grew up in.
Well, it sounds like a beautiful world.
What a perfect ending for a story that has so many coffins in it, right? Like, it just ends unexpectedly. That's right. That's the way it happens.
Yeah, right. Just sneaks up on you sometimes. Yeah. Paul, for anyone who's never been to a storytelling festival, what's the vibe? A little bird told me that at least for this Cincinnati storytelling festival, some people bring sewing projects.
Oh, I mean, that's not just in Cincinnati. That's everywhere. Like, almost every sort of festival of storytelling has, I don't know, 15, 20 people in the audience out of 100 that are either knitting or sewing or doing some sort of handcraft project while listening to the stories. So the vibe is really sort of a beautiful thing. It's people that are coming together as a community to listen to one another. And I don't think that was the intention whenever this sort of movement began in the early 70s, but it has become a thing that has been described as a bit of a respite from the fast-paced multitask, right? This is a kind of multitasking people are doing that is very different than like putting your TikTok up while you're on your commute as you're eating your breakfast burrito. Like, I think this is the thing, is when people are doing this sort of crafting and listening, they're connecting to people around them at the same time.
I actually made an entire quilt while listening to my co-storytellers tell stories. I think it's wonderful. I listen a lot of times. I listen better if I'm doing something in the room with my hands. And that's the big difference between somebody sewing or crocheting and being on their phone, is if they're on their phone, it's super distracting because I know they're not there in the tent. They're out there on the web somewhere. If they're making a quilt in the tent, they are right there with us in the tent. They are paying attention to me with their ears and to this sewing project with their eyes and their hands. And so they are just totally engaged in the room. And I think it's beautiful. Oh. In fact, a lot of tickets at storytelling festivals are actually quilt squares, little fabric squares that are used to make quilts.
And those are the passes that we use. The weekend passes and the day passes are, in fact, little swatches of fabric.
Oh, for the Cincinnati Storytelling
That's
Festival.
Right.
Well, Halloween is just around the corner. I know there will be twisted tales and spooky stories as part of the Cincinnati Storytelling Festival. Paul, do you have a story that can kind of serve as a bridge to that spookiness?
Sure. There's an old door lying out in the woods behind a mill in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and it's been there for decades, they say. It's got busted hinges and this half-rotten frame, and you would not think twice about it if you stumbled across it while hiking, but the story is that one winter, a long time ago, a man got caught in a snowstorm. And he pulled that door over him, kind of like a blanket, curled up under it for shelter, and they found him frozen there in the spring. And here's the thing. When they lifted the door off of his body, folks swear it made this sound. His body kind of, like the body was sort of hissing out underneath. Anyway, ever since then, they say if you crouch down beside that door and you put your hand on the knob turns. And not like loose or rusty, it turns against you sort of slow and steady, like somebody on the other side is trying to open it. And people argue about what happens if you let go. Like any one of these stories, some people will say it just stops. Some people will say that you can hear the scratching from the door. But everybody I've talked to about this story, they say the same thing about if you don't let go. Apparently, if you hang on just a little too long, that handle starts to jiggle a little.
I can't believe you caught me again. Oh my gosh. Last Halloween, I jumped out of my shoes when he told one of these stories. Oh gosh, I'm just an old lady here, Paul.
I'm so sad that this is on radio, because if people could have seen that reaction.
Oh, okay.
That's great.
Okay. Bill, I'm going to ask you this question first while I let Paul settle down after scaring me again. How do you think spinning yarns like this, telling stories like this, whether they're tall tales or spooky stories like that, how can this storytelling help us all stay connected to each other?
Well, almost all of my stories are about dumb things that I did and my buddies did when we were in elementary, junior, and high school. And it doesn't matter who you are or what your beliefs are, religious, political, whatever. If you were ever 13 years old, you were the epicenter of dumb. And when I start telling my stories about dumb things that me and my buddies did, I see people look at each other and they remember, I did a ridiculous thing when I was that age. We did something similar to that. And I'll have it. There might be 50 people in the audience. There might be 2,000 people in the audience. They're all in agreement that at that point in our life, we, on the one hand, made bad decisions, but on the other hand, they were the most beautiful decisions that we ever made in our life. And for 30 minutes, 45, 60 minutes, I just have people laughing, remembering, and all agreeing that we're the same. We come from the same place. We made the same bad decisions throughout our life. And so for those 30 beautiful minutes, everyone in that tent or in that room is in agreement. And we're just agreeing that we're happy, and that we're happy because every human has their foibles. And it doesn't matter who you are, how you identify, who you love, how you love, what your political stance is. For that little bit of time, we're just enjoying being human. And even more than that, we're enjoying being human together, because we're not just laughing at our own mistakes or at the things I'm saying on stage. We're looking around and we're seeing other people in the room that are leaning towards each other, smiling, remembering something. And it's just a beautiful, hilarious, peaceful 30 minutes.
I was telling some stories at some schools recently, and I was booked for 3 shows in the same school, K-3, 4-6, and then 7-12. And I got there and they were like, hey, we'll pay you the same. Can you just do one assembly with the whole school? So they lined them all up, and I ended up having to tell like little Bonnie Fufu down here to the kindergartners, while literally to my left, like those kids drove themselves to school, that, you know what I mean? And if you ever get a chance to tell stories to kindergartners and 12th graders at the same time, skip it, because it's not a great experience. But what ended up happening was I got in the middle of the story that I was telling for the older kids, and I kind of moved my fingers like somebody walking, and everybody started giggling, and I couldn't figure out why. And I looked. All the kindergartners were wide-eyed doing it with me.
Oh.
Because even at 5 years old, we realize what we're really doing is trying to find ourselves somewhere inside these stories, even if they're not meant for us. Storytelling gives people the opportunity to stop asking, is this for me? And start asking, where can I find myself inside of this?
Okay, Paul, I'm counting on you to take us home. And at the risk of my own dignity and sanity, do you have one more spooky story for us?
I have a spooky story for you that has no jump scares,
okay,
Lucy.
Okay, thank you, Paul.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
It's just
don't
creepy.
Don't believe him. He set you up.
Thank you, Bill. That sounds like an honest thing from a liar.
There's this bridge that fell about 80 years ago. A flood took it out. And if you stand on the cliff where it used to be, there is nothing there but air. But every September 16th, which was the night the flood took it, if you stand down by the riverbank and you look up through the mist, you can see the bottom of that bridge. The whole bridge, you can see it like it's still there, black against the moon, just hanging there like it never collapsed. And on September 16th is when Sue Ann shows up. Now, folks say she died on that bridge on that night. And they say if you go up to that cliff and you stand there long enough, Sue Ann shows up and she takes you by the arm. And if you step out onto that bridge that is not there together with her, you feel the bridge beneath you. And every plank, every rail is solid under your feet. You can walk all the way across that ghost bridge with Sue Ann. But the thing is, you can't walk the bridge back. Once you step off the far side, the boards completely vanish. Everything is gone again. And the only way home is the long way, which is down into the woods and scrambling up through the gullies and just switchbacking for hours. I've done that hike one time in the daytime, and it took a long time. So at night, I mean, you're going to be traveling until morning. And that's why most folks actually only make it about 10 steps across the ghost bridge. Plenty of people have died trying over the decades. They get up there, they let Sue Ann take them by the arm, they walk off the cliff, and they are walking on that ghost bridge. But every last one of them but one has looked down or has panicked and spun around, and that is when they fall 40 feet down in to the Rocky River. It happens at least once a decade, they say, but one man I know of made it all the way across, steady, arm in arm with Sue Ann's ghost the whole way. But once he got to the other side, he never came back.
Ooh, that's spooky. I have been talking with storyteller, author, and recording artist Bill Lepp, and storyteller, theater artist, and Cincinnati Storytelling Festival artistic director, Paul Strickland. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you for having us, Lucy.
Bill and Paul will perform at the Cincinnati Storytelling Festival happening November 13th through 15th. You can find more information, including how to get tickets, on our website, wvxu.org. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Ella Rowan. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.